Disc 7.
Why don't you call the bastard, Sandy suggested, or send him an email? I have an address for him, Alex. I started to wonder about the other players in the Four Horsemen game. Were there really four of them, or was that just the name of the game? Who were these players? How was the game actually played? Did all, or indeed any of them, act out their fantasies in real life? My message to Conqueror was simple and straightforward, and not too threatening, I hoped. I didn't see how he could resist answering me. Dear Mr. Highsmith, I'm a homicide detective in Washington, D.C., looking for information about Colonel Jeffrey Schaefer pertaining to the Four Horsemen. I understand that Schaefer worked for you in Asia. Time is of the essence. I need your help. Please contact Detective Alex Cross. Chapter 82. I was surprised when a message came right back. Oliver Highsmith, Conqueror, must have been online when my email went through. Detective Cross, I am well aware of you, since the ongoing murder trial is a rather big story in England, and in the rest of Europe, for that matter. I have known G.S. for a dozen years or more. He did work under me briefly. He is more an acquaintance than a close friend, so I have no expertise or bias about his guilt or innocence. I hope it's the latter, of course. Now, as to your question about the Four Horsemen, the game, and it is a fantasy game, Detective, is highly unusual in that all of the players assume the role of Game Master. That is to say, each of us controls his own fate, his own story. G.S.'s story is even more daring and unusual. His character, the rider on the pale horse, Death, is deeply flawed. One might even say evil. The character is somewhat like the person on trial in Washington, or so it seems to me. However, I must make a few important points. The appearance of any murder fantasies in our game always occurred days after reports of murders in the newspapers. Believe me, this was thoroughly checked by us once G.S. was accused. It was even brought to the attention of Inspector Jones at the Security Service in London, so I'm surprised you weren't informed before now. The service have been to see me about G.S., and they were completely satisfied, I assume, since they haven't been back. Also, the other players, who have themselves been checked out by security, are all represented by positive characters in the game. And as I've said, as powerfully involving as the horseman is, it is nevertheless only a game. By the way, did you know that by some scholarly accounts, there is a fifth horseman? Might that be you, Dr. Cross? FYI, the contact at the service is Mr. Andrew Jones. I trust he will vouch for the veracity of my statements. If you wish to converse further, do so at your own risk. I am 67 years of age, retired from intelligence, as I like to put it, and a rather famous windbag. I wish you much luck in your search for truth and justice. I miss the chase myself. Conqueror. I read the message, then reread it. Much luck in your search? Was that as loaded a line as it sounded? And was I now a player? The fifth horseman. Chapter 83. I went to court every day the following week, and like so many other people, I got hooked on the trial. Jules Halpern was the most impressive orator I had ever watched in a courtroom, but Catherine Fitzgibbon was effective as well. The verdict would depend on whom the jury believed more. It was all theater, a game. I remembered that as a kid I used to regularly watch a courtroom drama with Nana called The Defenders. Every show began with a deep-voiced narrator saying something to the effect of, "The American justice system is far from perfect, but it is still the very best justice system in the world." That may be true, but as I sat in the courtroom in Washington, I couldn't help thinking that the murder trial, the judge, the jury, the lawyers, and all the rules were just another elaborate game, and that Jeffrey Schaefer was already planning his next foray, savoring every move that the prosecution made against him. He was still in control of the game board. He was the game master. He knew it, and so did I. I watched Jules Halpern conduct smooth examinations that were designed to give the impression that his monstrous, psychopathic client was as innocent as a newborn baby. Actually, it was easy to drift off during the lengthy cross-examinations. I never really missed anything, though, since all the important points were repeated over and over, ad nauseam. Alex Cross. I heard my name mentioned and refocused my attention on Jules Halpern. He produced a blown-up photograph that had appeared in the Post on the day after the murder. The photo had been taken by another tenant at the Farragut and sold to the newspaper. Halpern leaned in close to the witness on the stand, a man named Carmine Lopez, a night doorman at the apartment building where Patsy Hampton had been murdered. "Mr. Lopez, I show you Defendant's Exhibit J, a photograph of my client and Detective Alex Cross. It was taken in the 10th-floor hallway soon after the discovery of Detective Hampton's body." The blow-up was large enough for me to see most of the detail from where I was sitting in the fourth row. The photo had always been a shocker to me. In it, Schaefer looked as if he had just stepped out of the pages of GQ. In comparison, my clothes were tattered and dirty. I had just come off my crazy marathon run from the zoo, and I had been down in the garage with poor Patsy's body. My fists were clenched tightly, and I seemed to be roaring out anger at Schaefer. Pictures do lie. We know that. The photograph was highly inflammatory, and I felt it could instill prejudice in the minds of the jurors. "Is this a fair representation of how the two men looked at 10:30 that evening?" Halpern asked the doorman. "Yes, sir. It's very fair. That's how I remember it." Jules Halpern nodded as if he were receiving vital information for the first time. "Would you now describe, in your own words, what Detective Cross looked like at that time?" he asked. The doorman hesitated and seemed slightly confused by the question. I wasn't. I knew where Halpern was going now. "Was he dirty?" Halpern jumped in and asked the simplest possible question.
Dirty? Sure. He was a mess."
"And was he sweaty?" the defense lawyer asked.
"Sweaty? Yeah, we all were. From being down in the garage, I guess. It was a real hot night."
"Nose running?"
"Yes, sir."
"Were Detective Cross's clothes ripped, Mr. Lopez?"
"Yes, they were. Ripped and dirty."
Jules Halpern looked at the jury first, then at his witness.
"Were Detective Cross's clothes blood-stained?"
"Yes, they sure were. That's what I noticed first, the blood."
"Was the blood anywhere else, Mr. Lopez?"
"On his hands. You couldn't miss it. I sure didn't."
"And Mr. Schaefer? How did Mr. Schaefer look?"
"He was clean, not mussed at all. He seemed pretty calm and collected."
"Did you see any blood on Mr. Schaefer?"
"No, sir, no blood."
Halpern nodded, then faced the jury.
"Mr. Lopez, which of the two men looked more like someone who might have just committed a murder?"
"Detective Cross," the doorman said without hesitation.
"Objection!"
the district attorney screamed, but not before the damage was done. Chapter 84. That afternoon, the defense was scheduled to call Chief of Detectives George Pittman. The assistant district attorney, Catherine Fitzgibbon, knew that Pittman was on the docket, and she asked me to meet her for lunch.
"If you have an appetite before Pittman goes on," she added.
Catherine was smart, and she was thorough. She had put away nearly as many bad guys as Jules Halpern had set free. We got together over sandwiches at a crowded deli near the courthouse. Neither of us was thrilled about Pittman's upcoming appearance. My reputation as a detective was being ruined by the defense, and it was a hard thing to watch and do nothing. She bit down into a hefty Reuben sandwich that squirted mustard onto her forefinger and thumb. Catherine smiled.
"Sloppy, but worth it."
"You and Pittman are really at odds, right? More like you hate each other's guts?"
"It's serious dislike, and it's mutual," I told her. "He's tried to do me in a couple of times. He thinks I'm a threat to his career." Catherine was attacking her sandwich.
Hmm. There's a thought. Would you be a better chief of detectives?
Wouldn't run, wouldn't serve if elected. I wouldn't be good cooped up in an office playing political ping-pong.
Catherine laughed. She's one of those people who can find humor almost anywhere.
This is just freaking great, Alex. The defense is calling the chief of detectives as one of its goddamn witnesses. He's listed as hostile, but I don't think he is.
Catherine and I finished off the rest of her sandwich.
Well, let's find out what Mr. Halpern has up his sleeve today, she said.
At the start of the afternoon session, Jules Halpern did a careful and thorough setup of Pittman's credentials, which sounded reasonably impressive in the abstract. Undergrad at George Washington, then law school at American. 24 years in the police force, with medals for bravery and citations from 3 different mayors.
Chief Pittman, how would you describe Detective Cross's record in the department? Asked Halpern.
I cringed in my seat, felt my brow wrinkle, my eyes narrow. Here we go, I thought.
Detective Cross has been involved in some high-profile cases that the department has solved, he said, and left it at that.
Not exactly praise, but at least he hadn't gone on the attack.
Halpern nodded sagely.
What, if anything, has changed his performance recently?
Pittman looked my way, then answered.
A woman he was seeing disappeared while they were on a trip together in Bermuda. Since that time, he's been distracted and distant, quick to anger, not himself.
Suddenly, I wanted to speak up in the courtroom. Pittman didn't know the first thing about Christine and me.
Chief Pittman, was Detective Cross ever a suspect in the disappearance of his girlfriend, Mrs. Christine Johnson?
Pittman nodded.
That's standard police procedure. I'm sure he was questioned.
But his behavior on the job has changed since her disappearance?
Yes. His concentration isn't the same. He's missed days of work. It's all a matter of record.
Has Detective Cross been asked to seek professional help?
Yes.
Did you ask him to seek help yourself?
I did. He and I have worked together for a number of years. He was under stress.
He's under a lot of stress, is that fair to say?
Yes. He hadn't closed a single case recently.
Halpern nodded.
A couple of weeks before the Hampton homicide, you suspended some detectives he was friendly with.
Pittman's look was somber.
Unfortunately, I did.
Why did you suspend the detectives?
The detectives were investigating cases outside the auspices of the department.
Is it fair to say they were making up their own rules, acting like vigilantes?
Catherine Fitzgibbon rose to her feet and objected, but Judge Fesco allowed the question.
Pittman answered, I don't know about that. Vigilantes is a strong word. But they were working without proper supervision. The case is still under investigation.
Was Detective Cross part of the group that was making up its own rules to solve homicides?
I'm not certain. But he was spoken to about the matter. I didn't believe he could handle a suspension at that time. I warned him and let it slide.
I shouldn't have, said Pittman.
No further questions.
None needed, I thought.
Chapter 85. That night, after he left the courthouse, Schaefer was flying high. He thought that he was winning the game. He was manic as hell, and it felt both good and bad. He was parked in the dark garage under Boo Cassidy's building. Most manics aren't really aware of it when they're exhibiting signs of a manic episode, but Schaefer knew. His spirals didn't come out of nowhere. They built and built. The irony and the danger of being back in her building weren't lost on him, scene of the crime and all that rot. He wanted to go to Southeast tonight, but that was too risky. He couldn't hunt, not now. He had something else in mind, the next few moves in his game. It was unusual, though not unheard of, for the defendant in a first-degree homicide trial to be out roaming the streets, but that had been one of the prerequisites of his dropping his immunity. What choice did the prosecution have?
None at all.
If the DA hadn't agreed, he had a free pass to keep him out of jail.
Schaefer followed a tenant he'd seen several times into the lift from the garage and took it to Boo's apartment. He rang the doorbell, waited, heard her padding across the parquet floor. Yes, Act One of tonight's performance was about to begin.
He knew she was watching him through the door's peephole, just as he had watched Alex cross through it on the night Patsy Hampton got her just desserts. He had seen Boo a few times after his release, but then he'd cut her off. When he'd stopped seeing her, she lost it. Boo had called him at work, then at home, and constantly on his car phone until he changed the bloody number. At her worst, she reminded him of the nutcase Glenn Close had played in the movie Fatal Attraction. He wondered if he could still push her buttons. She was a fairly bright woman, and that was a large part of her problem. She thought far too much. Double and triple think. Most men, especially dull-witted Americans, didn't like that, which made her even crazier. He put his face against the door, felt its cool wood on his cheek. He started his act.
"I've been petrified to see you, Boo. You don't know what it's been like. One slip-up, anything they can use against me, and I'm finished. And what makes it worse is that I'm innocent. You know that. I talked to you the whole time from my house to yours that night. You know I didn't kill that detective. Elizabeth. Boo. Please say something. At least curse at me. Let the anger out. Doctor."
There was no answer. He rather liked that. It made him respect her more than he had. What the hell, she was more screwed up than he was.
"You know exactly what I'm going through. You're the only one who understands my episodes. I need you, Boo. You know I'm manic depressive, bipolar, whatever the hell you shrinks want to call my condition. Boo."
Then Schaefer actually started to cry, which nearly made him laugh. He uttered loud, wrenching sobs. He crouched on his haunches and held his head. He knew he was a far better actor than so many of the high-priced fakers he saw in the movies. The door to the apartment slowly opened.
"Boo-hoo," she whispered. "Is poor Jeff in pain? What a shame."
What a bitch, he thought. But he had to see her. She was testifying soon. He needed her tonight, and he needed her help in the courtroom.
"Hello, Boo," he whispered back.
Chapter 86. Act Two of the evening's performance. She stared at him with huge, dark brown eyes that looked like amber beads, the kind she bought at her swanky shops. She'd lost weight, but that made her sexier to him, more desperate. She wore navy walking shorts and an elegant pink silk T-shirt. But she also wore her pain.
"You hurt me like no one ever has before," she whispered.
He held himself under control, play-acting, a truly award-winning performance.
"I'm fighting for my life. I swear all I think about is killing myself. Haven't you heard anything I've said? Besides, do you want your picture all over the tabloids again? Don't you see? That's why I've been staying away from you."
She laughed bitterly, haughtily.
"It's going to happen anyway when I testify. The photographers will be everywhere I go."
Schaefer shut his eyes.
"Well, that will be your chance to hurt me back, darling."
She shook her head and frowned.
"You know I wouldn't do that. Oh, Jeff, why didn't you at least call? You're such a bastard."
Schaefer hung his head, the repentant bad boy.
"You know how close I was to the edge before all this happened. Now it's worse. Do you expect me to act like a responsible adult?"
She gave a wry smile. He saw a book on the hallway table behind her. Man and His Symbols. Carl Jung. How fitting.
No, I suppose not, Jeff. What do you want? Drugs? I need you. I want to hold you, Boo. That's all.
That night she gave him what he wanted. They made love like animals on the gray velvet love seat she used for her clients, then on the JFK-style rocking chair, where she always sat during sessions. He took her body and her soul. Then she gave him drugs, antidepressants, painkillers, most of her samples. Boo was still able to get the samples from her ex, a psychiatrist. Schaefer didn't know what their relationship was, and frankly, he didn't care. He swallowed some Librium and shot up Vicodin at her place. Then he took Boo again, both of them naked and sweating, and frenzied on the kitchen counter. The butcher block, he thought. He left her place around 11. He realized he was feeling worse than before he'd gone there, but he knew what he was going to do. He'd known before he went to Boo's. It would explode their little minds, everyone's, the press, the jury. Now for Act 3. Chapter 87. At a little past midnight, I got an emergency call that blew off the top of my head. Within minutes, I had the old Porsche up close to 90 on Rock Creek Parkway, the siren screaming at the night, or maybe at Jeffrey Schaefer. I arrived in Kalorama at 12:25. EMS ambulances, squad cars, TV news trucks were parked all over the street. Several neighbors of the Schaefers were up and had come outside their large, expensive houses to observe the nightmare scene. They couldn't believe this was happening in their upscale enclave. The chatter and buzz of several police radios filled the night air. A news helicopter was already hovering overhead. A truck marked CNN arrived and parked right behind me. I joined a detective named Malcolm Ainsley on the front lawn. We knew each other from other homicide scenes, even a few parties. Suddenly, the front door of the Schaefer house opened. Two EMTs were carrying a stretcher outside. Dozens of cameras were flashing. "It's Schaefer," Ainsley told me. "Son of a bitch tried to kill himself, Alex. Slit his wrist and took a lot of drugs. There were open prescription packets everywhere. Must have had second thoughts, though. Called for help." I had enough information about Schaefer from the discovery interviews preceding the trial, and from my own working profile on him, to begin to make some very educated guesses about what might have happened. My first thought was that he suffered from some kind of bipolar disorder that caused both manic and depressive episodes. A second possibility was cyclohemia, which can manifest itself in numerous hypomanic episodes as well as depressive symptoms. Its associated symptoms could include inflated self-esteem, a decreased need for sleep, excessive involvement in pleasurable activities, and an increase in goal-directed activity. In Schaefer's case, maybe an intensified effort to win his game. I moved forward as if I were floating in a very bad dream, the worst I could imagine. I recognized one of the EMS techies, Nina DeCisa. I'd worked with her a few times before in Georgetown. "We got to the bastard just in time," Nina said, and narrowed her dark eyes. "Too bad, huh?" "Serious attempt?" I asked her. Nina shrugged. "Hard to tell for sure. He hacked up his wrist pretty good. Just the left one, though. Then the drugs. Lots of drugs. Doctor's samples." I shook my head in utter disbelief. "But he definitely called out for help?" "According to the wife and son, they heard him call out from his den, 'Daddy needs help. Daddy is dying. Daddy is sick.'" "Well, he got that part right. Daddy is incredibly sick. Daddy is a monumental sicko." I went over to the red and white ambulance. News cameras were still flashing all over the street. My mind was unhinged, reeling. Everything is a game to him. The victims in Southeast, Patsy Hampton, Christine. Now this. He's even playing with his own life.
"His pulse is still strong," I heard as I got close to the ambulance. I could see one of the EMT workers checking the EKG inside the van. I could even hear beeps from the machine. Then I saw Schaefer's face. His hair was drenched with perspiration, and his face was as pale as a sheet of white paper. He stared into my eyes, trying to focus.
Then he recognized me.
"You did this to me,"
he said, mustering strength, suddenly trying to sit up on the stretcher.
"You ruined my life for your career. You did this. You're responsible. Oh, God, oh, God, my poor family. Why is this happening to us?"
The TV cameras were rolling film, and they got his entire Academy Award-quality performance. Just as Jeffrey Schaefer knew they would. Chapter 88. The trial had to be recessed due to Schaefer's suicide attempt. The courtroom shenanigans probably wouldn't resume until the following week. Meanwhile, the media had another feeding frenzy, including banner headlines in the Washington Post, the New York Times, USA Today. At least it gave me time to work on a few more angles. Schaefer was good. God, he was good at this. I had been talking with Sandy Greenberg nearly every night. She was helping me collect information on the other game players. She had even gone and talked with Conqueror. She said she doubted that Oliver Highsmith was a killer. He was late 60s, seriously overweight, and wheelchair-bound. Sandy called the house at 7 that night. She's a good friend. Obviously, she was burning the midnight oil for me. I took the call in the sanctuary of my attic office.
"Andrew Jones of the Security Service will see you," she announced in her usual perky and aggressive manner. "Isn't that great news?" "I'll tell you, it is. Actually, he's eager to meet with you, Alex. He didn't say it to me directly, but I don't think he's too keen on Colonel Schaefer. Wouldn't say why. Even more fortuitous, he's in Washington. He's a top man. He matters in the intelligence arena. He's very good, Alex. A straight shooter."
I thanked Sandy, and then immediately called Jones at his hotel. He answered the call in his room.
"Yes, hello, it's Andrew Jones. Who is this, please?"
"It's Detective Alex Cross of the Washington Police. I just got off the line with Sandy Greenberg. How are you?"
"Good, very good. Well, hell, not really. I've had better weeks, months.
Actually, I stayed here in my room hoping that you'd call. Would you like to meet Alex? Is there some place where we wouldn't stand out too much?" I suggested a bar on M Street in half an hour, and I arrived there a minute or two early. I recognized Jones from his description on the phone.
"Broad, beefy, red-faced, just your average ex-rugby type, though I never bloody played. Don't even watch the drivel. Oh yes, flaming red hair and matching mustache. That should help, no?"
It did. We sat in a dark booth in back and got to know each other. For the next 45 minutes, Jones filled me in on several important things, not the least of which was politics and decorum within the English intelligence and police communities, Lucy Schaefer's father's good name and standing in the army, and the concern for his reputation, and the desire of the government to avoid an even dicier scandal than the current mess.
"Alex, if it were true that one of our agents committed cold-blooded murders while posted abroad, and that British intelligence knew nothing about it, the scandal would be a true horror and a major embarrassment. But if MI6 knew anything about what Colonel Schaefer is suspected of doing, well, it's absolutely unthinkable."
"Did it?" I asked him. "Is this situation unthinkable?"
"I won't answer that, Alex. You know I can't. But I am prepared to help you if I possibly can."
"Why?" I asked then. "Why now? We needed your help on this before the trial began."
"Fair question. Good question. We're prepared to help because you now have information that could cause us a hell of a lot of trouble. You're privy to the unthinkable."
I said nothing. I thought I knew what he was alluding to, though.
"You've discovered a fantasy game called the Four Horsemen. There are four players, including Schaefer. We know you've already contacted Oliver Highsmith. What you probably don't know yet, but will find out eventually, is that all the players are former or current agents. That is to say, Jeffrey Schaefer might be just the beginning of our problems."
"All four of them are murderers?" I asked. Andrew Jones didn't answer. He didn't have to. Chapter 89.
We think that the game originated in Bangkok, where three of the four players were posted in 91. The fourth, Highsmith, was a mentor to George Bayer, who is Famine in The Four Horsemen. Highsmith has always worked out of London.
Tell me about Highsmith, I said.
As I said, he has always been in the main office, London. He was a high-level analyst. Then he actually ran several agents. He's a very bright chap, well thought of.
He claimed that The Four Horsemen was just a harmless fantasy game.
It may be for him, Alex. He may be telling the truth. He's been in a wheelchair since 85. Automobile accident. His wife had just left him, and he cracked. He's an enormous fellow, about 300 pounds. I doubt that he's getting about and murdering young women in the scuffier neighborhoods of London. That's what you believe Schaefer was doing here in Washington? The Jane Doe murders?
Jones was right, and I didn't deny it.
We know he was involved in several murders, and I think we were close to catching him. He was picking up his victims in a gypsy taxicab. We found the cab. Yes, we knew about him, Andrew.
Jones tented his thick fingers, pursed his lips.
You think Schaefer knew how close you and Detective Hampton were getting?
He may have known, but there was a lot of pressure on him.
He made some mistakes that led us to an apartment he rented.
Jones nodded. He seemed to know a great deal about Schaefer, which told me he'd been watching him, too. Had he been watching me as well?
How do you think the other game players might react to Schaefer as being so out of control? I asked. I'm fairly sure they felt threatened. Who wouldn't? He was a risk to all of them. He still is.
Jones continued.
So, we have Schaefer, who's probably been committing murders here in Washington, acting out his fantasies in real life. And Highsmith, who probably couldn't do that, but could be a sort of controller. Then there's a man named James Whitehead in Jamaica. But there have been no murders of the Jane Doe variety on that island, or any other one nearby. We've checked thoroughly. And there's George Bayer in the Far East.
What about Bayer? I assume you've investigated him, too.
Of course. There's nothing specific in his record, but there was an incident, a possible connection to follow up on. Last year in Bangkok, two girls who worked in a strip bar in Pot Pol disappeared. They just vanished into the noisy, teeming streets. The girls were 16 and 18, respectively, bar dancers and prostitutes. Alex, they were found nailed together in the missionary position, wearing only garters and stockings. Even in jolly old Bangkok, that caused quite a stir. Sound distressingly similar to the two girls who were killed in Eckington?
I nodded. So we have at least two unsolved Jane Does in Bangkok. Has anyone actually questioned Bayer?
At this point, no. But he's being watched. Remember the politics, the fear of a scandal that I mentioned earlier? There's an ongoing investigation of Bayer and the others, but to some extent our hands are tied.
My hands aren't tied, I said to Jones. That's what you wanted me to say, isn't it? What you expected? It's why you met with me tonight. Jones turned very serious.
It's how the world works, I'm afraid. Let's do this together from here on. If you help us, I promise to do what I can to find out what happened to Christine Johnson.
Chapter 90. The trial resumed sooner than expected, the following Wednesday, in fact. There was speculation in the press about how serious Schaefer's self-inflicted wounds had been. None of the public's perverse interest in the case seemed to have been lost. It seemed impossible to predict the outcome, a fact of life I tried not to let get me down too much. Both Schaefer and I were present in the packed courtroom that first morning back. Schaefer looked pale, weak, an object of sympathy, perhaps. I certainly couldn't take my eyes off him.
Things got stranger and stranger. At least they did for me. Sergeant Walter Jamieson was called that morning. Jamieson had been at the police academy when I attended it. He had taught me my craft, and he was still there teaching others. I couldn't imagine why he would be called as a witness in Patsy Hampton's murder case. Jules Halpern approached the witness with a heavy-looking hardback book open in his hands.
I read to you from the textbook, Preserving the Crime Scene, A Detective's Primer, which you wrote 20 years ago, and which you still use in your classes. It is imperative that the detective not disturb the crime scene until backup can be brought in to corroborate charges affected by the detective to unearth evidence, lest those charges be misconstrued to be those of the perpetration. Gloves must be worn at all times at a crime scene. Did you write that, Sergeant Jamieson?
Yes, I did. Most certainly. 20 years ago, as you said.
Still stand by it? Halpern asked.
Yes, of course. A lot of things have changed, but not that.
And you heard earlier testimony that Detective Cross wore gloves both inside Detective Hampton's car and at the Cassidy apartment?
Yes, I heard the testimony. I also read the grand jury transcripts.
Halpern turned on the overhead projector in the courtroom.
I direct your attention to prints number 176 and 211 provided by the DA's office. You see the ones denominated?
Numbers 176 and 211, I see them.
Now, the prints are denominated Detective Hampton Belt Buckle, ID Alex Cross Right Thumb, and Left Side Dashboard, ID Alex Cross Left Forefinger.
What does that mean? Can you explain the markings to us?
It means that Alex Cross's prints were found on Detective Hampton's belt, as well as on the dashboard of her car.
Jules Halpern paused for a full 10 seconds before he went on.
And may we not therefore conclude, Sergeant Jamieson, that Detective Cross himself may be our murderer and rapist?
Objection!
Catherine Fitzgibbon stood up and shouted.
Withdrawn, said the defense attorney. I'm finished here.
Chapter 91. Lawyers for both the prosecution and the defense continued to appear regularly on Larry King and other TV shows and to boast that their cases were slam dunks. If you listen to the lawyers, neither side could lose. In the courtroom, Jules Halpern had the fierce look and body language of someone brimming with confidence and determination. He was riding the case hard. He looked like a jockey whipping his thoroughbred to victory. The bailiff stood and announced,
"The defense calls Mr. William Paez."
I didn't recognize the name. Now what? Now who?
There was no immediate response in the courtroom. No one came forward. Heads craned around the room. Still no one responded. Who was the mystery witness? The bailiff repeated a little louder,
"Mr. Paez? Mr. William Paez."
The double doors in the back of the room suddenly opened, and a circus-style clown walked in. The gallery began to whisper loudly, and a few people laughed. What a world we lived in. What a circus indeed. The clown took the stand, and both the prosecution and the defense were immediately called forward for a sidebar by Judge Fesco. A heated discussion ensued that none of the rest of us could hear. The clown issue was apparently resolved in favor of the defense. After being sworn in, the clown was asked his name for the record. With his white-gloved right hand raised, he said,
"Billy."
The bailiff asked, "Last name, please." The clown said,
"First name, Silly. Last name, Billy. Silly Billy. I had it legally changed,"
he turned and confided to the judge. Jules Halpern then took over, and he treated the clown with respect and seriousness. First he asked him to state his credentials, which the clown did politely. Then Halpern asked,
"And what brings you here today?"
"I did a party for Mr. Schaefer out in Calorama on the fateful and terrible night of the murder. It was his twin's 5th birthday. I did a party when they were 4 as well. I brought a video along. Want to see?"
he said, speaking as if he were addressing a crowd of 3-year-olds.
"Of course," said Jules Halpern.
"Objection!"
Catherine Fitzgibbon called out loudly. The video was admitted over the prosecution's objections, and after yet another lengthy sidebar. The newspapers had claimed that Judge Fesco was intimidated by Jules Halpern, which seemed the case. The tape began with an arresting close-up of a painting of a clown's face. As the camera pulled back, everyone in the courtroom could see it was the sign on Silly Billy's van, which was parked in front of a handsome red-brick townhouse with a glass conservatory linked to the main building. The Schaefer House. The next scene showed Silly Billy ringing the front bell and apparently surprising the Schaefer children at the door. Once again, the prosecution objected to the videotape. There was another sidebar. The lawyers returned to their seats, and the tape resumed. The other children at the birthday party then ran to the door. The clown handed out toys from a sack slung over his shoulder, teddy bears, dolls, shiny red fire trucks. Silly Billy then performed magic tricks and gags on the sun porch, which looked out onto the backyard. The yard was very pretty, with potted orange trees, white climbing roses, jasmine vine, lush green grass.
"Wait! I hear something outside!"
he turned and said into the camera. He ran and disappeared from sight. The kids all followed. The tension of surprise and imminent fun showed in the children's eyes. A cream-colored pony appeared, cantering slowly around the corner of the house. Silly Billy was riding the pony. But when the clown dismounted, the kids discovered that the clown was actually Jeffrey Schaefer. All the kids went wild, but especially the Schaefer twins. They ran and hugged their daddy, who seemed the perfect father. There were heartwarming, candid shots of the children eating frosted cake and playing party games. There were more shots of Schaefer laughing and playing with several of the children. I suspected that Jules Halpern had supervised the final editing of the tape. It was very convincing. The adult guests at the party, all dressed up and looking sophisticated, gave glowing testimonials. They said that Jeffrey Schaefer and his wife were outstanding parents. No longer in his clown costume, but in a smart navy suit, Schaefer modestly deflected the tributes. He had changed into the same clothes he wore when he was apprehended at the Farragut. The tape ended with the smiling and quite beautiful twins telling the camera that they loved their mommy and daddy for making their dream come true. The lights came up. The judge granted a brief recess. I felt incredibly angry that the video had been shown. It made Schaefer out to be a wonderful father. And such a victim. The jury was all smiles, and so was Jules Halpern. He had argued masterfully that the tape was crucial to establishing Jeffrey Schaefer's state of mind shortly before Patsy Hampton's murder. Halpern was so skillful an orator that he'd actually made the outrageous request to show the video sound logical. At any rate, it was moot now. Schaefer himself was smiling broadly, as were his wife and son. It suddenly occurred to me that Schaefer had been riding a pale horse at the party for his children. He was Death from the Four Horsemen. It was all theater and games to him, his entire life. Chapter 92. Sometimes I wanted to shut my eyes tight and not have to watch another moment of the trial. I wanted things to be the way they'd been before the weasel. Catherine Fitzgibbon was doing a very good job with each witness, but the judge seemed to be favoring the defense whenever possible. It had begun at the critical suppression hearing, and it continued now. Lucy Schaefer took the witness stand early that afternoon. The warm, homespun videotaped images of the Schaefer family were still fresh in the minds of the jurors. I had been trying to understand Lucy Schaefer's odd and perplexing relationship with her husband since the first time I met her on the night of Patsy Hampton's murder. What kind of woman could live with an unrepentant monster like Schaefer and not know it? Could this woman be that much in denial? Or was there something else that motivated her, somehow held her captive to Schaefer? I had seen all kinds of marital relationships in my therapy practice, but nothing like this. Jane Halpern conducted the questioning and looked every bit as confident in winning as her father. She was tall and slender, with wiry black hair tied in a bow with a dark crimson ribbon. She was 28, just 4 years out of Yale Law School, but seemed older and wiser.
"Mrs. Schaefer, how long have you and your husband known each other?"
Lucy Schaefer spoke in a gentle but clear voice.
"I've known Jeffrey for most of my adult life, actually. My father was his commanding officer in the army. I believe I was just 14 when I first met Jeff. He was 9 years older. We married when I was 19, after my second year at Cambridge. Once, when I was studying for exams, he showed up at university in full military dress, polished saber, medals, shiny black leather riding boots, right in the middle of the library. I was studying in a sweatshirt, or some such awful get-up, and I don't think I'd washed my hair in days. Jeff told me it didn't matter. He didn't care a bit about appearances. He said he loved me, and always would. I must tell you, he's kept that promise."
"Very nice," Jane Halpern said, seemingly utterly charmed, as if she'd never heard the story before.
"And has he remained romantic?" "Oh, yes, even more so. Scarcely a week goes by when Jeff doesn't bring me flowers, or perhaps a beautiful Hermes scarf which I collect. And then there are our ouch excursions."
Jane Halpern wrinkled her nose, and her dark brown eyes twinkled.
"What are ouch excursions?" she asked, with the exuberant curiosity of a morning TV show host. "Jeff will take me to New York, or maybe Paris, or back to London, and I get to shop for clothes until he says, ouch. He's very generous that way." "A good husband, then?" "The best you could imagine. Very hard-working, but not so much that he forgets about his family. The children adore him."
"Yes, we could tell that from this morning's film, Mrs. Schaefer."
"Was the party an unusual occasion?" "No. Jeffrey's always throwing parties. He's very joyful, full of life, full of fun and surprises. He's a sensitive, very creative man."
I looked from Lucy Schaefer to the jury box. She had the jurors in a spell, and they couldn't take their eyes off her. She was also credible. Even I had the sense that she genuinely loved her husband, and more important, that she believed he loved her. Jane Halpern milked the testimony for all it was worth. I couldn't blame her. Lucy Schaefer was attractive and seemed nice, kind, and obviously was very much in love with her husband and adored her children, but she didn't appear to be a fool. Just someone who had found exactly the man she wanted and valued him deeply. That man was Jeffrey Schaefer. It was the indelible image the jurors took away with them at the end of the day. And it was an amazing lie spun by a master. Chapter 93. I talked things over with Andrew Jones when I got home after court that afternoon. I tried to contact Oliver Highsmith again, but so far hadn't gotten any response. Also, there was nothing new to link Schaefer to the Jane Doe murders in Washington. Schaefer didn't seem to have murdered anyone, at least locally, in the past several months. After a dinner of chicken pot pie, salad, and rhubarb pie, Nana gave the kids the night off from their chore of doing the dishes. She asked me to stay and help, to be her
partner in grime, as we used to call it.
"Just like the good old days, same as it ever was," I said, as I splashed soap and water onto silver and dishes in the porcelain sink. "That's as old as the house." Nana dried the kitchenware as quickly as I got it to her. Her fingers were still as nimble as her mind.
"I like to think we're older and wiser," she chirped.
"I don't know. I'm still the one getting dishwater hands."
"I haven't told you something, and I should have," Nana said, going serious on me.
"Okay," I said, and stopped splashing water and soap bubbles around in the sink. "Shoot."
"What I wanted to say is that I'm proud of the way you've been able to handle the terrible things that have happened. Your strength and your patience have given me inspiration. And I'm not easily inspired, especially by the likes of you. I know it has had the same effect on Damon and Jenny. They don't miss a thing."
I leaned over the sink. I was feeling in a confessional mood. "It's the worst stretch of my life. The hardest thing I've ever had to do. It's even worse than when Maria died, Nana, if that's possible. At least back then I knew for sure she was dead.
I could let myself grieve. I could finally let her go and breathe again. Nana came around the sink and took me in her arms, which always surprised me with their strength. She looked me squarely in the eyes, just like she always has, since I was around 9 years old. She said,
"Let yourself grieve for her, Alex. Let her go."
Chapter 94.
Jeffrey Schaefer had an attractive, loving wife, and that incongruous and monstrously unfair fact bothered me a lot. I couldn't understand it as a psychologist or as a detective. The clever testimony of Lucy Schaefer continued early the following morning and lasted just over an hour. Jane Halpern wanted the jury to hear more about Lucy's wonderful husband. Finally, it was Catherine Fitzgibbon's turn. In her own way, she was as tough and maybe as formidable as Jules Halpern.
"Mrs. Schaefer, we've all been listening to you intently, and it all sounds very charming and idyllic. But I'm troubled and confused by something. Here's what troubles me. Your husband tried to commit suicide 8 days ago. Your husband tried to kill himself. So maybe he isn't quite what he seems to be. Maybe he isn't so well-balanced and sane. Maybe you're mistaken about who he really is."
Lucy Schaefer stared directly into the prosecuting attorney's eyes.
"In the past few months, my husband has seen his life, his career, and his good name falsely put in jeopardy. My husband couldn't believe that these horrible charges were made against him. This whole Kafkaesque ordeal drove him, quite literally, to despair. You have no idea what it means to lose your good name."
Catherine Fitzgibbon smiled and then quipped,
"Sure I do. Of course I do. Haven't you read the National Enquirer lately?"
That got a laugh from the courtroom audience, even the jury members. I could tell that they liked Catherine. So did I.
She continued, "Isn't it true that your husband has been treated for despair for many years? He's seeing a psychologist, Mrs. Schaefer. He suffers from manic depression or bipolar disorder, correct?"
Lucy shook her head.
"He's had a midlife crisis. That's all it is. It's nothing unusual for men his age."
"I see. And were you able to help him with his crisis?"
"Of course I was. Although not with respect to his work. So much of what he does is classified and top secret. You must understand that."
"I must," the prosecutor said, then quickly went on, "So your husband has a great many secrets he keeps from you?"
Lucy frowned, and her eyes shot darts at the wily prosecutor.
"In his work, yes." "You knew that he was seeing Dr. Cassidy? Boo Cassidy?"
"Yes, of course I did. We often talked about it."
"How often did he see her? Do you know? Did he tell you that, or was it top secret?"
Jane Halpern shouted, "Objection!" "Sustained, Ms. Fitzgibbon," warned Judge Fesco, with an arched brow.
"Sorry, Your Honor. Sorry, Lucy. All right, then. How often did your husband see Boo Cassidy?"
"He saw her as much as necessary, I suppose. I believe her name is Elizabeth."
"Once a week? Twice? Every day?" Fitzgibbon pressed on, without missing a beat.
"I think once a week. Usually it was once a week."
"But the doorman at the Farragut testified that they saw your husband much more than that. 3 or 4 times a week on average."
Lucy Schaefer shook her head wearily and glared at Fitzgibbon.
"I trust Jeffrey completely. I don't keep him on a leash. I certainly wouldn't count his therapy sessions."
"Do you mind that Dr. Cassidy, Elizabeth, was such an attractive woman?"
"No, don't be absurd."
Fitzgibbon looked genuinely surprised.
"Why is that absurd?"
"I don't think it is. I think I'd mind if my husband was seeing an attractive woman at her home office 2, 3, 4 times a week."
Fitzgibbon moved swiftly.
Didn't it bother you that Boo Cassidy was a surrogate sex therapist for your husband?
Lucy Schaefer hesitated, seemed surprised, and glanced quickly at her husband. She hadn't known. It was impossible not to feel sorry for her. Jane Halpern quickly rose from her seat.
Objection. Your Honor, there is no foundation that my client was seeing a sex surrogate.
Lucy Schaefer visibly pulled herself together on the witness stand. She was clearly stronger than she looked. Was she a game player, too? Could she be one of the players? Or did she and her husband play a completely different kind of game? She spoke.
I'd like to answer the question. Madam Prosecutor, my husband, Jeffrey, has been such a good husband, such a good father, that even if he felt it necessary to see a sex therapist, and did not want to tell me about it because of the hurt or shame he felt, I would understand. And if he committed cold-blooded murder and did not want to tell you?
The prosecutor asked, then turned to the jury. Chapter 95. Elizabeth Boo Cassidy was in her late 30s, slender and very attractive, with lustrous brown hair that she had worn long since she was a young girl. She was a regular shopper at Neiman Marcus, Saks, Nordstrom, Bloomingdale's, and various chic specialty shops around Washington. It showed. She had gotten the nickname Boo as an infant because she always laughed and laughed whenever she heard the sound of somebody playing peekaboo with her. She soon learned to do it herself, muttering, "Boo, boo, boo, boo." In school, right through college, she kept the name, friends said, because she could be a little scary at times. For her important day in court, she'd chosen a single-breasted pantsuit, beautifully cut, very soft and flowy. Her outfit was an eye-pleasing mix of coffee and cashmere cream. She looked like a professional person, and a successful one. Jules Halpern asked her to state her name and occupation for the record. He was amiable, but businesslike, a little cooler than he had been with the other witnesses.
"Dr. Elizabeth Cassidy, I'm a psychotherapist," she replied evenly.
"Dr. Cassidy, how do you know Colonel Schaefer?"
"He's a patient of mine, and has been for over a year. He sees me at my office at 1208 Woodley Avenue once or twice a week. We increased the frequency of the sessions recently after Mr. Schaefer's attempted suicide."
Halpern nodded. "What time are the sessions?"
"Usually early evening. They can vary according to Mr. Schaefer's work schedule."
"Dr. Cassidy, I direct your attention to the evening of the murder of Detective Hampton. Did Jeffrey Schaefer have a therapy session with you that night?"
"Yes, he did. At 9 p.m. From 9 until 10. I think he may have arrived a little earlier that night, but the session was scheduled for 9.
"Could he have arrived as early as 8:30?
"No, that isn't possible. We were talking to each other on cell phones from the time he left his house in Kalorama until he arrived at my building. He was feeling a great deal of guilt about his latest dark moods coming too close to his daughter's birthday party."
"I see. Was there any break in your conversation with Colonel Schaefer?"
"Yes, but it was a very short one."
Halpern kept the pace brisk. "How much time elapsed between the time the two of you stopped talking on the cell phone and his arrival at your office?"
2 or 3 minutes, 5 at the most. While he parked and came upstairs, no more than that."
"When he arrived at your office, did Jeffrey Schaefer seem unsettled in any way?"
"No, not at all. He appeared relatively cheerful, actually. He had just hosted a successful birthday party for the twins. He felt it had gone very well, and he dotes on his children."
"Was he out of breath, tense, or perspiring?" Halpern asked.
"No, as I said, he was calm and looked quite fine. I remember it quite clearly, and after the intrusion by the police I made careful notes to keep everything accurate and fresh," she said, then glanced at the prosecution table.
"So you made notes for the sake of accuracy?"
"Yes, I did."
"Dr. Cassidy, did you notice any blood anywhere on Colonel Schaefer's clothing?"
"No, I did not."
"I see. You saw no blood on Schaefer. And when Detective Cross arrived, did you see any blood on him?
Yes. I saw dark stains or streaks of blood on his shirt and suit coat. Also on his hands.
Jules Halpern paused to let everything sink in with the jury. Then he asked a final question.
Did Colonel Schaefer look as if he had just murdered someone? No, certainly not.
I have nothing further, said the defense attorney. Daniel Weston did the cross-exam for the prosecution. He was 29 years old, bright, quick-witted, a rising star, and known to be a ruthless hatchet man in the prosecutor's office. Dan Weston was also good-looking, blonde, and rugged. He got physically close to Boo Cassidy. They made a fetching couple, which was precisely the visual idea he wanted to communicate.
Ms. Cassidy, you weren't Mr. Schaefer's psychiatrist, were you?
She frowned slightly, but then she managed a weak smile.
No, a psychiatrist has to be a medical doctor. You know that, I'm sure.
And you are not a medical doctor? She shook her head.
I am not. I have a doctorate in sociology. You know that, too.
Are you a psychologist? Weston asked.
A psychologist usually has a graduate degree in psychology, sometimes a PhD.
Do you have a graduate degree in psychology?
No. I'm a psychotherapist.
I see. Where did you train to be a psychotherapist?
American University. I graduated with a PhD in social work.
Daniel Weston kept coming at Cassidy. There was hardly a beat between answer and question. This psychotherapy office of yours at the Farragut, what sort of furnishings does it have?
A couch, desk, lamp. It's basically very spare. Lots of plants, though. My patients find the atmosphere functional, but also relaxing.
No box of tissues by the couch? I thought that was a must, Weston said with a wry smile. The witness was clearly annoyed now, and maybe even shaken.
I take my work very seriously, Mr. Weston. So do my patients.
Was Jeffrey Schaefer referred to you by someone?
Actually, we met at the National Gallery, at the Picasso Erotic Drawings exhibit. That's been covered in depth by the press.
Weston nodded, and a thin smile crossed his lips. Ah, I see. Are your sessions with Jeffrey Schaefer erotic? Do you ever discuss sex? Jules Halpern rose quickly, a regular Jules in the box. Objection. Doctor-patient privilege. It's confidential. The young prosecutor shrugged and flipped back his blonde curls with his hand. I'll withdraw the question. No problem. Are you a sexual surrogate?
No, I am not. As I stated earlier, I am a psychotherapist.
On the evening of the murder of Detective Hampton, did you and Jeffrey Schaefer discuss? Jules Halpern quickly rose again. Objection. If the prosecution is inquiring into the patient's privileged disclosures... Weston raised both arms in frustration. He smiled at the jurors, hoping they felt the same way. All right, all right. Let me see. I'll take this out of this so-called doctor-patient realm and ask you, quite simply, if you, Ms. Cassidy, a woman, have had sexual relations with Jeffrey Schaefer, a man. Elizabeth Boo Cassidy hung her head and stared down at her lap. Daniel Weston smiled, even as Jules Halpern objected to the question, and was upheld by Judge Fesco. Weston felt that he had made his point. Chapter 96. Call Detective Alex Cross. I took a deep breath, composed my mind, body, and soul, then walked up the wide center aisle of the courtroom to testify. Everyone in the room was watching me, but the only person I really saw was Jeffrey Schaefer. The weasel. He was still playing the part of the wronged innocent man, and I wanted to bring him down. I wanted to cross-examine him myself, to ask the real questions that needed to be asked, to tell the jury about all the suppressed evidence, to bring justice down on him with all its crushing force.
It was a hard thing to have worked honestly for so many years and now be accused of being a rogue cop, someone who had tampered with evidence and perhaps worse. It was ironic, but now maybe I would have the opportunity to set the record straight, to clear my name. Jules Halpern smiled cordially at me as I sat down in the witness stand. He established eye contact, quickly looked over at the jury, then turned back to me. His dark eyes radiated intelligence, and it seemed an incredible waste that he was working for Schaefer. "I want to start by saying that it is an honor to meet you, Detective Cross. For years, I, like most of the jurors, I'm sure, have read in the Washington papers about the murder cases you have helped solve. We admire your past record." I nodded and even managed a grudging smile of my own. "Thank you. I hope you'll admire my present and future record as well," I said.
"Let's hope so, Detective," Halpern said. He moved on.
We parried for half an hour or so before he asked,
"You suffered a terrible personal tragedy a short time before the arrest of Colonel Schaefer. Could you tell us about it?"
I fought the urge to reach out and grab the polite-sounding, insidious little man by the neck. I leaned closer to the mic, struggled for control. "Someone dear to me was kidnapped while we were in Bermuda on vacation. She's still missing. I haven't given up hope that she'll be found. I pray every day that she's still alive." Halpern clucked sympathetically. He was good, much like his client.
"I really am sorry. Did the department give you adequate time off?"
"They were understanding and helpful," I said, feeling my jaw stiffen with resentment. I hated that Halpern was using what had happened to Christine to unsettle me.
This book is continued on Disc 8.